Industrial history is filled with stories of miracle products that could be used for many, many purposes, and over time resulted in many, many injuries and even deaths for people involved in the manufacturing process. Such as the story told in the book Fake Silk about the chemical used to make rayon and sponges and rubber tires and a whole lot more. The book is subtitled The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. We stress the lethal effects are not on product users but on manufacturing workers. It is the work of Paul David Blanc, an MD, a professor of medicine and holder of the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. This is a return visit to the exchange. Paul joined us in February 2010 to talk about an earlier book, How Everyday Products Make People Sick, which certainly sparked a spirited discussion on the program. Paul David Blanc, good to have you back on the exchange.
Well, good to be back.
So I want to make it clear at the outset, we're not talking about dangers to the end users again, right? This is not something that happens to people who own the sponges or the rayon clothing or the rubber tires or any of that stuff?
That's absolutely correct. I like to say that the people who wear a rayon shirt are no more at risk than the person who wears a cotton T-shirt that they bought in a warehouse store for half of what it should have cost because somebody put their life at risk at a 15th-floor walk-up in Bangladesh, a sweatshop worker. So it's the same issue, really.
So it does seem like, and this is a theme in your work, obviously, in the past, is that industrial history is quite littered with stories where we knew the risks fairly early on and yet didn't act upon them very quickly.
That's correct. I like to describe it as a kind of cyclical amnesia where the word gets out, especially the medical side of it. But then after a few years, it's forgotten, and people then rediscover it 10 years later or 20 years later, repeatedly.
So let's talk about the bad actor here and clear up some terminology. Carbon disulfide, not carbon dioxide. What is carbon disulfide?
Well, it's a simple little molecule. It's one carbon linked to two sulfurs. And it doesn't occur much in nature, although in the mouths of volcanoes and some other rarefied places. But it was invented synthetically in the end of the 18th century.
So do we call it viscose or do we call it rayon? Are the terms interchangeable?
They're somewhat interchangeable. Viscose is the basic process by which rayon is made. And once you make other things, such as cellophane or viscose sponges, then it's not rayon, but it's exactly the same materials.
All right, there are whole bunches of products made from this. I mean, what is the short list?
Well, in addition to sponges and in addition to long thread for rayon, there's also a big, big market in short pieces of thread. The long thread is cut up into short pieces, and then it can be used as a mix. And that's why people, when they buy something which is 20% viscose, they don't really realize it's rayon because it's these chopped up fibers mixed with wool or with cotton or with polyester.
Just a few sentences into the process that makes this, you realize that there's some really bad stuff going on in here.
Yeah, it's an extremely toxic chemical.
How is it toxic? What does it do to human beings or for anybody, I guess, for that matter?
Yeah, well, with very high levels of exposure, which is what was going on, particularly in the 19th century, but well into the 20th as well, people would simply go insane. It causes a kind of acute paranoid psychosis. In fact, one of the rubber companies where this was used in the 19th century, they put bars on the second-story windows because workers had a tendency to jump out. With lower level, longer exposure, people develop loss of nervous sensation and ability to walk, become impotent. And then with prolonged exposure, other neurologic effects include Parkinsonism. And then in the 1950s and 60s, it became clear that even longer term exposure was linked to premature heart attack and stroke.
And how long does the exposure have to be before people begin to notice effects?
Well, with the insanity and high-level exposure, it occurs within days to weeks to months. With the longer-term exposure, it's years.
Wow. And I'm just there's a picture that we used on our website that shows the process of creating the filaments. And when I was reading about the stuff that's actually in that beaker, it was pretty astounding. I mean, this is some pretty nasty stuff all around in this manufacturing process. What's in it?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. You take wood pulp or some other form of cellulose, you mix it with caustic, you let it sit around, you add this chemical called carbon disulfide. It makes a very thick, yellowish syrup that's a kind of toxic maple syrup, if you will. And then you force it through pipes and through these tiny nozzles in underneath the bath of sulfuric acid. And when this liquid hits the sulfuric acid, cellulose, pure cellulose, is regenerated, but then the carbon disulfide bubbles out into the workroom of the workers unless there are special precautions taken.
Okay, so the sulfuric acid strips away the gooey parts and keeps the tougher fibrous parts.
Yes, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's called regenerated cellulose, because it's pure cellulose. There's no longer any carbon disulfide there. It's not actually linked molecularly to the cellulose. There are some other cellulose-based methods where you actually alter the backbone of the cellulose, but not for rayon.
So let me ask the question about the use of carbon disulfide or viscose rayon or the stuff we're talking about here. The same question asked about lead, about red phosphorus, about a long list of chemicals. I mean, how long did it take before people started to actually do things on behalf of the workers?
Well, they're still not necessarily doing much if you think about the rayon industry in India and China and Indonesia. And in fact, we still have large manufacturing of a kind of relative of cellophane, a thin viscose film, which is the preferred synthetic casing for sausages. So for those in your listening audience who are into skinless weenies, this is how they're made.
Wow. Okay, so more to find out about the history of viscose rayon, all the products it goes into, and all the things that have happened to people who work with it. To this day, Paul DeBlanc's book is called Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Come back and talk more with him, and if you'd like to join the discussion, we'll take phone calls and emails as well when we return to The Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Paul David Blanc. He is a medical doctor and a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and has written a few times about chemicals and bad things going on in the environment, particularly in exposure to workers. His latest book is called Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon, a product that goes into the making of clothing and sponges and tires and a lot of other products, and has done some bad things to people over the years with some really awful neurological effects, insanity, blindness, other neurological damage involved. Join the discussion on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, is there a total somewhere of people who've been harmed or killed in the manufacturing process?
No, there isn't. But I will tell you that in the 1930s, when this was looked at systematically in the United States, about 30% of the workers that were studied had significant neurological problems. And at that time, there were many thousands of people who were employed in the industry before it was shut down.
Well, and when you mentioned the 1930s, it makes me realize that this was not a time when people felt like they could leave jobs because they were concerned about their health or safety.
That's correct. And despite the height of the Depression, actually this industry was booming. It was increasing worldwide nearly algorithmically, exponentially, I mean.
You describe your research process as not going in straight lines but in circles. What do you mean by that?
Well, one thing leads to another, and it just you never know where the trail is going to take you. I was often quite shocked by what I would come across as I was doing the research. And so you just have to pursue every lead. It's like being one of those detectives on Law and Order or something.
Without the dun-dun going on. I wonder if the revelations kept surprising you along the way. I mean, you've been down this road before and have written about a lot of things that were just awful chemicals are in use and people don't seem to question it and it does bad things to people over time. But, I mean, did you reach points in the process of researching fake silk where you went, oh, my God, this is the worst thing I've ever seen, and then found a worse thing beyond that?
Yes, I'd say that. I mean, what really was astonishing when I started to delve into it was the extent to which the the Germans used slave labor and concentration camp labor throughout Europe to run these factories during the war years. And I had come across one report that suggested that, but as I looked into it, it was far more systematic.
Is that partly because the Germans knew that they didn't want to put their own people in those factories?
Partly because they did have actually fairly strict control limits if you were an Aryan. So there was an element of that. And of course, it was just their general approach to forced labor in the period. Mm-hmm. But some of these factories actually operated with satellite concentration camp labor.
Wow. So let's go to the history of the stuff itself. How long has carbon disulfide and its other byproducts been in use, and where start?
Well, as I said, it was synthesized first at the end of the 18th century, but actually by the mid 19th century, it was in fairly widespread use in the rubber industry. The rayon process, the viscose process, was invented at the turn of the last century, so just before 1900 it was patented, and then it took off very quickly. Actually, one of the first factories in the world was in Pennsylvania, and that was where the first medical report in the first decade of the 20th century came out of. And almost at the same time, there was a small factory in the outskirts of Moscow where another outbreak occurred. Even though the larger producers were in Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, but the literature from those countries, the medical literature, was very sparse for another 2 to 3 decades.
I'm still kind of curious how people hit upon this. Was the use of the chemical process discovered on the way to look for something else? I mean, were they trying to do a different kind of thing?
Well, it's just a fantastic solvent. So there was a British inventor who figured out that you could vulcanize rubber using this. It wasn't the main process. The main process was done in huge factories with hot presses and sulfur, but this process was ideal for small dipped items, and the process really took off in Paris in small workshops, and there was a physician in Paris who started seeing these cases and by the middle of the century started to report them in a great amount of detail. The big industry in Paris of small dipped rubber items was the emerging condom industry.
Really? So they could make condoms well from
rubber.
This process, yeah.
Yeah, and also the balloon industry, the rubber balloon industry, which was kind of new at the time.
Well, you know, it seems like early scientists might have figured out that a chemical so strong might have an effect on living tissue. I mean, it actually had been used as an anesthetic in some cases by this
and
point.
And rejected. Uh-huh. Rejected very early on. So one of the very first research anesthesiologists in Britain, a man named Jon Snow, no relation to Game of Thrones.
Oh, right.
he studied this and rejected it very quickly. He studied it in humans.
So here's a somewhat familiar name. You mentioned the French industry. Duchenne comes in here. This is the guy from whom we have the phrase Duchenne smile. What did he figure out about this process or this stuff?
Well, he was a neurologist, and he also reported on the neurologic toxicity of this chemical. In fact, the people who wrote from France on the neurologic effects of this chemical are kind of a who's who, including Charcot and Marie, as in Charcot-Marie tooth disease. It's really impressive.
So how did the industry react to it? I mean, we're still talking before the Civil War, so this is the 18th...
Well, no, after. This okay. is after, mostly. Mm-hmm. The way the industry reacted was to go on with business as usual, and they only really got rid of carbon disulfide in the rubber industry when they found even more effective substitutes that were related and, in fact, which break down in the body to carbon disulfide. And one of those related chemicals is currently a licensed pharmaceutical called disulfiram, generically, or Anabuse is one of the names, and it's used in alcohol aversion therapy. This is a drug you give people, and if they fall off the wagon,
They get sick, actually, yeah.
They get violently ill. Mm-hmm. But this drug is actually broken down in the human body to yield carbon disulfide, and you can even follow whether somebody is taking their medicine by measuring the amount of it, carbon disulfide they exhale in their breath.
Wow. We're talking to Dr. Paul David Blanc about fake silk, the lethal history of viscose rayon, his book. And here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Again, I'm saddened to hear profits before people. You know, this is an ongoing theme in almost all components of heavy industry. I had two basic questions. First of all, how does this material have to be absorbed into the body? Is it something where it has to be breathed in, or is it something that's a result of skin contact? And then secondly, how can this be prevented, and how much does it drive up the unit cost of an average good provided with this? And I know that second one's a tall question, but that's it, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, it can be absorbed through the skin or inhaled. It's got a vapor pressure that puts it into the air pretty effectively, but it would be a great skin passing through chemical because it's such a great solvent. In terms of the cost of doing business by enclosing this chemical, in fact, it would probably ultimately pay for itself, because what you do is you recapture the carbon disulfide and you use it again. So in a modern factory in Austria, for example, that I visited, it's very tightly enclosed, and the workers are followed very carefully in terms of whether they have any absorption of the chemical, and they do pretty well. Of course, that factory, which is quite successful, has a large enterprise in China, and I don't know what the practices are there.
I'm curious about when you went into that factory in Austria, if you were sort of primed to notice whether things smelled funny and what you were expecting and what you got.
Well, what I was expecting was to see what I saw, which was a modern factory and good controls met with the medical department. But of course, there were other parts of it that were that gave one pause. They were very open, and they're very open about their history during the war. But they had an older worker who's no longer a line worker who took me around. He took me up one of their towers. For some reason, these factories always have towers. Not they have smokestacks too, but they have these multi-story things that are kind of like storage places or whatever. And we went up to this fifth floor of this thing and looked over the factory grounds. And he said very proudly to me that the last suicide from there was in the 1950s. And then he paused and he said, "Of course, during the war, we had quite a bit more."
Wow, that's an interesting story. Are the effects of exposure to carbon disulfide and viscose rayon reversible in any way? I mean, if you get away from it for a while, will you recover, or is it just the damage is done and it stays done?
Well, no, the people who had acute insanity would often recover. They were often sent to mental hospitals, and rarely was the connection between their exposure and their disease made. One famous case report, it was only when the third person came in with acute insanity from the same rubber factory that a doctor put it together. But problems such as Parkinsonism and heart attack and stroke, those are not reversible particularly.
Well, and back to the not at all. And back to Paul's question about money. This is a common theme in the industrial age, and one that you've run across, I'm sure, quite a few times in your work. I mean, what generally happens when expenses meet science?
Well, in fact, the workers' compensation system is not designed at all to give the negative feedback that would make something happen. Because, first of all, for occupational disease, typically the connection is never made. In fact, in the 1930s, when all this was going on in Pennsylvania largely, Pennsylvania didn't even recognize occupational disease in its compensation system, just injury, a physical injury.
So if you fell off the catwalk, you'd get a compensation, yeah, but not right. If you went insane from the fumes.
Yeah, lousy compensation, but something. So that's one problem, but I don't think that's only a small piece of it. And unfortunately, it's the same kinds of problems were present in state capitalism as well. after the war, there was a huge rayon industry in East Germany. Those factories all shut down after the economic collapse when in reunification. But I did go and visit with former workers there and saw the factory site and so forth. It was a huge factory that had been a big operation under the Nazis, and then after the war was revitalized in the German Democratic Republic.
Paul David Blanc is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a medical doctor and the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, the author of a new book called Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. We're talking about the horrible neurological effects of viscose rayon and carbon disulfide. So you visited with some of the former workers at those East German factories. What kind of shape were they in after their exposures, and how much?
They were okay. You know, the people that survived. And I also met with former workers in Sweden. So Sweden had a factory which was half owned by the National Labor Union, and that one had terrible exposure also.
We've talked about the rubber industry thus far as we talk about the history of the product, and also about the fact that it was used and rejected as an anesthetic in the 19th century. But there was also a use in the wine industry too. Is that right?
Well, it was used well into this century, into this last century, I should say, as a pesticide, and it was going to be everyone's savior in the phylloxera epidemic of the 19th century. Of course, all it ended up doing was exposing a lot of people who were injecting it into the soil. But even after that time, it was the preferred way to kill gophers. There was a factory in California that marketed this stuff as a gopher killer, and that persisted. And in fact, the EPA only banned it as a fumigant in the 1970s. I believe it was used in grain mixed with something else that was nasty. I think with carbon tetrachloride or something unbelievable combination of toxins. Of course, now with what's happening, maybe it'll be brought back as a fumigant.
You do have some concerns, I can imagine, with the new management at the EPA.
Yeah.
And OSHA and the other organizations involved in worker safety.
Yes. Absolutely.
You're going to leave it at yes?
Yes.
All right. Haven't talked that much about the garment industry yet. I mean, when was carbon disulfide and this process used for cloth?
So beginning around 1900,
mm-hmm.
And even before the First World War, it was already a very big business. It's really the prototype of the multinational corporation. From the beginning, these were interlocking directorates of companies that were based in Britain and France and Germany and Italy. In Britain, Courtaulds was the biggest kid on the block, and they were actually the biggest producer in America. They had a wholly owned subsidiary called the American Viscose Corporation, which eventually went into competition with DuPont, or DuPont went into competition with them, and between the two of them, they had about 85 or 90% of the U.S. market, and the U.S. was the biggest producer.
One sentence in the process jumps out when you write that caustics and acids were downright cheap, but I mean, I have to believe that the cheapness was not figuring in environmental and human costs.
Well, that's correct. That's the cost, when cost-benefit analysis is hoisted upon people, they kind of forget that the costs and the benefits often accrue to different groups.
We have an email question here from Boyd in Wolf Creek, who wants to know, are there newer rayon processes that don't use toxics, and are there toxic residues in the current rayon fabric supply?
Well, the first thing is that there is not any residue of carbon disulfide, again, to the consumer. And yes, there is one alternative that's used, and the patent is owned by that same company in Austria, and it uses a different chemical, which has a very long name and has the initials NMMO, I believe. And frankly, I couldn't find much, if any, toxicological information about that chemical in terms of animal testing or human data. It is hard to believe that there could be a chemical worse than carbon disulfide, I'll say that much. But as such, that's still a very limited market. And it is a bit more expensive product.
You mentioned the recapture of the gases, which keeps the workers safe. I mean, are they ever vented to the outside? I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
These are huge sources of point environmental contamination where these things are made. But tying that release to human health effects in the surrounding areas is very hard, if not impossible. There was a famous court case of a couple in Alabama that were near the last functioning carbon disulfide using rayon factory, Axis, Alabama, and they sued because their horses, their prize horses, were dying from carbon disulfide poisoning. But they never won because there was some legal loophole about it being a nuisance and you couldn't sue for a nuisance, or it wasn't a nuisance and you can only sue for a nuisance. I forget what the technicality was, but it went to the Alabama Supreme Court.
Wow. Much more to talk about with Paul David Blanc. His book is Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Paul David Blanc, doctor as in MD. He's a professor of medicine and holder of the endowed chair in occupational and environmental medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's written extensively about products and their manufacturing processes that are dangerous and downright lethal to people. And he follows that up with his latest work, Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. It does not affect the end user, so rayon shirts and your kitchen sponges and your tires aren't going to hurt you, but they certainly can cause some problems for the people who make them if they're not properly protected. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the American duopoly, anyway, between American Viscose, which was a subsidiary of Courtauld, the British company, and DuPont. Were you able to assess approximately how big the company was at its biggest, how many workers were making products from viscose rayon and carbon disulfide?
Well, there were thousands of them. You know, probably it could have been close to 10,000. There aren't great numbers. I can tell you that it was such a big business that the quid pro quo for the Americans, the American Congress and the American administration putting through Lend-Lease in the 40s was for Courtauld to turn American Viscose into a public company, to let go of it.
Really? That was a condition of Lend-Lease?
It was the political precondition for it going to Congress.
Wow. Marcus Hook, Pennsylvania, where American Viscose set its biggest plant up, was that right?
That was its first plant, but mm-hmm. There are later ones were even bigger.
So were the company towns where, I mean, this was, hey, we make rayon, this is what we do? I mean, were there dedicated communities that were really believed in the process?
No, generally they were, sometimes they were the biggest factory in the town, but actually, for Marcus Hook, they hired an architectural firm to make a garden village for the workers, a model village. So it's a little bit like, the prisoner, if you will, that old TV show.
The TV show, right? Where they.
I was able to get a secondhand copy of the promotional little booklet on this model village, modeled after some of the things that were built in England.
So you'd mentioned that one of the last remaining plants was in Alabama using the prize. Is there any rayon made in the continental United States anymore?
Oh, there's a lot of viscose made, but there's no rayon fiber. So there's the largest, supposedly the largest cellophane factory in the world is in the United States. It's in Kansas, mm-hmm. And then the viscose based sausage casing producers are in multiple locations in the United States.
So the sausage casing stays with the sausage. You mentioned skinless wieners, so they stay with it, or are they just using them in the manufacturing process?
They're used as a sort of a placeholder, uh-huh, for you to put the sausage in. When you eat the sausage, you don't eat the viscose film. No.
Okay. You did mention some politics getting involved here with Lend-Lease just before, actually, once the Second World War had started and we weren't in it yet. There's other political stories in here. In fact, a pretty good story from British Parliament in 1928. There was a debate about this very subject?
Yeah, they had actually more than one debate. And there was a guy named, whose nickname was Jix. He was the Home Secretary. He was really quite an unpleasant person politically, and he basically got up and lied. It's hard, you know. There aren't that many smoking guns. They're cleverer than that, but this was one of them that was easily pointable, mm-hmm. point-outable, whatever the word would be.
I guess the thing that surprises me most about the fact that there was a debate in Parliament in 1928 is not that the debate happened, but that people were pointing fingers and saying, hey, look, you know, this industry hurts people. And this was 70 years after some of the first French scientists were saying, hey, look, we can trace some neurological effects to exposure to this process.
Well, that comes back to the cyclical amnesia I was mm-hmm. describing. Yes, the French reported it, the British reported it too, and then there were reports, again, the process was invented in 1899, more or less. By 1904 or 5, there were the first medical reports in the rayon industry.
And so nothing was done, or people chalked it up to something? I guess I'm wondering if there was a process similar to what seems to happen with the refutation of science today, where there are efforts to discredit the people who bring up the science or find nasty things about their backgrounds, or if it went to that extent with trying to discredit the people who were saying, hey, look, there's some dangers from viscose rayon and carbon disulfide.
You know, I don't think in terms of the some of the techniques that have been used with the tobacco industry and with asbestos, no, I don't think it went that far. I sometimes use the analogy of the Kubler-Ross stages of death and dying, but it actually never goes much beyond denial.
So I guess the denial, but there's no bargaining, no acceptance, none of the other
right.
stuff. Right.
Right.
So when you mentioned cellophane, we haven't brought that fully into the picture yet, because it's kind of curious to think about the fact that something that makes opaque fibers for the use of, you know, rubber tires, condoms we mentioned earlier, clothing. How did it end up used in cellophane? Is that a very, very different process?
No, it's exactly the same process up to the very last stage. And then instead of pushing the fluid through these little nozzles, you push it through a thin slit and make a film.
Okay, so what? I guess when I think about all the god-awful chemicals, because you use caustics at some point, so you're using base sorts of, I mean, high pH products, and then there's the sulfuric acid to make the actual filaments as you force it out through there. So, I mean, are the chemicals used over and over again? And if not, I mean, what do they do with the spent chemicals?
Well, they have, you know, the usual waste ponds and neutralize it and all that. Although I will say that some of these factories have been sources of water pollution, certainly in Virginia. Some of the earliest, in fact, industrial water pollution studies looked at these factories. There was one in Roanoke that was a bad player, and some of these closed-down factories are currently EPA Superfund sites, or have been EPA Superfund sites.
Oh, because they still got ponds or tanks or soil. Yes. Areas of and, well, this just raises the question then, too, that you mentioned the East German industry and many factories there that got closed down with the collapse, economic collapse upon the reunification of Germany. I have to believe there are some issues there as well. I mean, a lot was said about behind the Iron Curtain when it existed, how much looking the other way there was and environmental concerns there.
Yes, absolutely. The one that I visited was right on the Elbe River, actually, right abutting it, because you want, you know, shipping and all that stuff and a big supply of water. There was a huge factory in Cornwall, Ontario, that was owned by Courtauld's, even after they had to give up control of the U.S. company. They kept that one as a subsidiary.
So who are the players in the game? Now, you mentioned Courtauld's was the huge player. That was a British-based corporation at its peak. I imagine it still exists, it sounds like, in some form. And is DuPont still involved as well?
No. DuPont got out of the business. For a long time, In fact, their big cash cow was cellophane, but they got out of that business eventually, too. They took a cellophane case all the way to the Supreme Court because they wanted to keep the name cellophane as a copyrighted trade name. And, and they I forget all the machinations, but there was a famous a dissent in that case against them. But I think they might have won part of it and lost. I'm a little confused on all the details now, but I do know it was just to point out that this was big stakes.
Yeah, absolutely. It went all the way to the Supreme Court in this case. Yeah. And I think I might have talked over you when you were mentioning what's going on. Is there still a court holds?
No, there isn't.
Okay.
And then I now remember what happened was DuPont lost the copyright thing because that was with another competitor in the U.S., but then they were charged with collusion and, you know, price fixing or something like that, and they won that case because the Supreme Court found that all wrapping papers were the same, and so even if you had a corner on the cellophane market, there was still aluminum foil and other things.
Wow, it's just amazing what happened.
Chief Justice, the Chief Justice wrote a defense, dissent on it. It was quite interesting.
So, was there ever really a turning point? Was there ever a front page story that said, you know, oh, good heavens, what's happening to all these workers? Or did it just sort of happen slowly and incrementally over the years?
Yeah, there was never a single turning point. I will say that another post-war afternote to the rayon business was they started to market something called brushed rayon. And I haven't actually gotten to the bottom of it, whether it was viscose rayon or some other ones that are even more flammable. But this became quite the scandal because these brushed rayon clothing articles would catch fire. The sweaters came to be called torch sweaters, and it was what really gave the impetus to the first regulation for flame-proof clothing in the United States in the early 1950s.
Wow, and I remember all this.
So that's an example of where a press story really did start to change something. But again, it's because when consumers come into the mix, all of a sudden there are other factors.
Oh, so when there are dangers to the users of the end product versus the dangers to the people involved in the manufacturing,
that's
it's a
correct.
Different kind of thing.
Right.
And so does it seem the pressure? I mean, because obviously your last book was, or the one we talked to you about 7 years ago, was called How Everyday Products Make People Sick. And so did action come faster on those products than they ever came for the people who manufactured viscose rayon?
Well, in general, you know, come back to the, you know, workers' comp. You can't sue your employer if you're injured, but if you're a consumer, a third party that's injured, you can. And so there's a legal exposure. That's what happened, in fact, with the artificial butter-flavored popcorn story, which was going on, smoldering on for years, maybe a decade, with workers becoming ill. And when the first consumer case occurred of someone who might have had lung disease from artificial butter-flavored popcorn, the next day it was taken off the market.
Wow, that is fast. Question here, no town given, but it's an interesting question. I wants to ask you about the fabric Tercel and whether you know about any bad conditions to manufacture it.
Well, Tercel is the trade name for this substituted chemical that's made in Austria, a substituted chemical-based rayon made in Austria. And as I noted, there's not great toxicology information on that substitute chemical, but it is hard to believe that it could be as bad as carbon disulfide.
So did the industry change processes, Paul, ultimately, or did it just, because it seems like the demand for the kinds of products that could be made are probably still rather high, and so I'm going to guess that they either changed their processes or moved to countries where their environmental regulations were less.
Well, they are. The textile industry is in Indonesia and India and China, and we know virtually nothing, especially about Indonesia and the Indian industry. And in terms of the other industry using it, it's hard to know. There really have been very few studies of the sponge industry, medical studies, for example.
You mentioned in the book, too, there's been some greenwashing of of this process and the products.
Yes, I call it greenwashing. It's like saying that because you make rayon from wood pulp or cellulose, therefore it's a green product because it's not petroleum-based, and it completely ignores the fact that carbon disulfide is a very bad player, and it is not natural. It's made either from coal or from natural gas, depending on your production method. So it's quite a cynical marketing ploy, and they do it the biggest with bamboo, by the way, as a source of cellulose.
Oh,
or rayon.
Huh.
So people buy bamboo-based fabric and think, oh, this is great, you know.
I'm just still stunned by the basically we're taking fiber from nature and smashing it into really, really tiny pieces and then trying to reconstitute it later on through a process that involves many, many bad chemicals.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's what caterpillars do, right?
Oh, well, I suppose, but their own digestive processes.
Right.
Wow. It's an amazing story with so many different facets to it, a story well told. Paul David Blanc is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and the author of Fake Silk, The Lethal History of Viscose Rayon. Paul, good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much.